The Sisters of the Islamic Center of Bloomington invite you to explore hijab from a personal perspective. We want to share the importance of hijab, why we choose to wear it, and what it means to us, in the hopes that by listening to our stories, you will come to better understand who we are as Muslims, women, and humans. The Hijabi Diaries. Muslim women speaking for themselves.
You're listening to The Hijabi Diaries. I'm Aubrey Cedar. Before we get started today, I just wanted to remind all of our listeners that the podcast is available to download and stream for free via iTunes and the Stitcher mobile radio app. If you want to have new episodes of The Hijabi Diaries queued up and ready to go on your smartphone for your daily commute, for an upcoming road trip, or whatever, go to The Hijabi Diaries iTunes page on your podcast app and click subscribe. Easy peasy, and you will never have to worry about missing another episode ever again. So today on the podcast, we are talking about Ramadan. Ramadan is the ninth month in the Muslim calendar, which is also a lunar calendar, by the way. Ramadan moves around in the Gregorian calendar because the lunar calendar has approximately 11 and a half fewer days than the Gregorian. This year, Ramadan started super early, way back on May 17th. Ramadan is 30 days long, and if you know nothing else about Ramadan, you probably know that Ramadan is all about fasting. For 30 days, Muslims participating in Ramadan do not eat or drink, no, not even so much as a sip of water, from sun up to sundown, every day. Why do they do this? Well, we'll get deeper into that question later, but the simple answer is because Ramadan is one of the five pillars of Islam, a command given by God to his people. Some people also add their own personal reasons, many that are actually passed down by religious scholars and become popular schools of thought. For example, some say that Ramadan brings us closer to God through our personal sacrifice, choosing not to eat even though our body is screaming for food, and dedicating this Herculean effort to God. Some say that through our good deeds, millions of dollars are donated to charities around the world every year during Ramadan, we get closer to God. And others say that we get closer to God through our solidarity during this month with people all over the world who don't have enough food to eat or clean water to drink. To me, Ramadan sounds like a lovely idea, but like a brutally difficult practice. The days are 18 hours long in the American Midwest in late May and early June. How did my friends do it? To my Muslim friends, however, Ramadan is an amazing time. It's a special time, a time of community, celebration, and renewed devotion to God. It is really hard to understand just what Ramadan is like for a Muslim individual or for a family unless you're experiencing it from the inside. Mornings are spent up before dawn, stuffing food into your face, trying to drink enough liquid to last you an entire 80-degree, 100% humidity Midwestern summer day. Sometimes before dawn, you get to the mosque to pray, or sometimes as quietly as you can, you pray at home before the kids wake up. Evenings are spent breaking fast with family, with friends, or at the mosque. That first sip of water, or that first bite of the dates that they use here at the ICOB to break the fast every evening, those are the most satisfying things. Knowing how difficult this experience is to communicate from an outsider's perspective, or to sum up in one story, I asked my friend Abby if she could set aside some time to record short reports from the field throughout the month. She agreed. Here are some of Abby's reports from the first 3 weeks of Ramadan 2018.
Ramadan day two. You're huddled on your front porch at 4:55 in the morning. You know you can't smoke or drink water, and you're just huddled on the porch in the darkness pretending like all your bad habits are going to go away after the 5 o'clock Fajr alarm. And you're smoking and simultaneously pouring water down your gullet to stuff your body full of as much nutrients and fluids as possible before you spend the whole day dying for a drink.
So it's obvious, right, that Abby is a mom. And motherhood can really change the way that women participate in Ramadan. There is actually scripture in the Quran that describes exemptions for women from participating in Ramadan. I guess that even God keeps in mind that pregnancy and breastfeeding really take a toll on the body. Our co-producer Anna Mighty talks to us about her experience doing Ramadan as a mom.
The first time I fasted was before I converted to Islam. And Shaban, who's my husband now, he fasted every Ramadan. And so I saw this and I saw his family fast. And I saw the way they came together for dinner every night and this kind of thing. And actually, Ramadan was one of the probably most, like, I probably didn't realize the effect it was having on me at the time, but I really loved his family dynamic and the way they fasted together and broke fast together. And his mom cooked for them every night. And even his mother isn't Muslim, but she still cooked for them every night so that they could break their fast. And she made cookies. You know, it's like special time. There's cookies and there's special soup and things like that. So I think it really had an impact on me in the way I like was learning about Islam and also learning about Shaban's family. So the first time I fasted, I think, was kind of inspired by that I had seen him doing it for a couple years. And I was like, well, I kind of want to see if I can do a day, you know, like I'll try a day or two. And I don't even actually remember how many days I fasted. It may have only even been one day. But I really liked it. I felt like I was a part of something. I felt like I was a part of what Shaban was going through. And I also felt like I was a part of Shaban's family more in a way. And I don't know that I necessarily felt like I was a part of Islam yet, because I don't think I converted until like a year later or something like that. But probably I was starting to feel the beginnings of that and just didn't realize it at the time. So my first experience with fasting was that I really liked it, not only in terms of physically how it makes you feel, but emotionally how it makes you feel, kind of like, hey, I did this. I did something. And at the time, I wasn't even doing it for God. I was doing it kind of for myself and kind of not for Shaban specifically, but as in wanting to get to know him better, to try to get to know him better. Through experiencing what he's experienced. But then about a year later probably was, because I think I converted. Yeah, I converted right before Ramadan. So I converted and then like a few weeks later, I had my first Ramadan. So that was the first time I did all 30 days. And oh, I wish I could remember the feeling better now. It's been so long since I fasted. But I mean, alhamdulillah, it just means like all praise is to God. It's a wonderful feeling and it's hard to explain. But each day you fast, you know, the first day is pretty tough because you're used to eating whenever you want for the past year. So the first day is kind of rough. But every day that you succeed and, you know, control your hunger and control your body and control your mind, you are a little more practiced at doing it for the next day. And by the end of 30 days, I just remember having this feeling like, why do we ever eat during the day? Like, why don't we always fast? Like, it's not that hard. Now, I'm speaking as like a young, healthy individual at that time. Of course, it's very different depending on who you are and what your life circumstances and health circumstances are. But for me at the time, it felt just the perfect amount of difficult, that it was a constant reminder of.
Anna has three sons who are all under the age of 6. She's talked to me before about how her and her husband Shaban want to have 4 kids, want to have them all fairly close together, and about how she wants to breastfeed each of them. As she says, she loves Ramadan, and she has tried, most recently last year, to participate in the daily fasts even while pregnant or while breastfeeding. But she's found that, in her case, fasting is just not possible.
It's very different. This is my 7th Ramadan that I'm not fasting. I have tried to fast at various points. For example, when there was a point where I was nursing, but my sons were a little bit older, and I thought, well, if my milk supply goes down, we can just wean. They're older, you know, it's not like it's an issue like when they're an infant. But what I've found of my own body is that my milk supply does not go down. I just start to starve. So if I try to fast but then can't make up the calories in such a short period of time at night, my body keeps producing just as much milk and taking from my stores in order to do so. So it was completely unsustainable, unfortunately.
Dale Spicer is a scholar of Islamic studies and a PhD candidate in the School of Religious Studies at Indiana University, Bloomington.
I specialize in Islamic studies, specifically sort of the classical period of Muslim history. It begins with sort of the birth of the Prophet Muhammad in 570 CE, and then it goes on until sort of the medieval period around the 13th century, 14th century. It depends on who you ask, really.
Now, Dale would want me to tell you that he himself is not a practicing Muslim and that he speaks from a scholar's perspective rather than a practitioner's.
In the Muslim tradition, there's sort of this practice of fasting or salm. The Quran is actually the source for the tradition that we have today, Ramadan, where it's specifically set aside as a month for fasting, and some of the general guidelines for what you would have to do to observe a fast are laid out in the Quran itself, particularly in the second surah.
So I ask the obvious question, why are we fasting? Does God in the Quran give a reason why he specifically wants his human followers to give up food? And, by the way, also give up sex. You are also not allowed to have sex during the daylight hours of Ramadan as part of the fast. And to give up these things for a month, every single year. Turns out that there's not a simple answer. Well, maybe it's a simple answer, but it's a little unsatisfying for the curious minds among us.
So the simple answer is that it is obligatory in the Quran. It says that you must.
So it doesn't give a reason? It's not like, this is why. It just says you should do this.
Yes. The idea is that God is commanding you to do things, and you can look at it a couple different ways. You can look at it as in that God commands things because they are good, or you can also look at it from a different sort of theological lens, that God commands things because he's God and he can. And so I think you would find Muslims who would fall on both sides of that it's done because God said so, or it's God said so because it's good for us.
It turns out that there are many individuals and communities out there that are, for some reason, unable to participate in the daily fasting that Ramadan requires without causing themselves significant health problems. Diabetics, for example. Chronic health problems like diabetes and the challenges that they present modern Muslims is something that goes totally unaddressed in the Quranic scriptures on Ramadan. So, what is to be done? Dale explained to me that there are serious debates taking place as to whether or not taking regular medication, such as insulin, during daylight hours in the month of Ramadan is considered by scholars and religious leaders to be breaking the fast.
There's actually a lot of really interesting research taking place right now in the medical health community who are interested in sort of the scientific facts of fasting. And so one of the big questions is, does it actually do anything for people, you know, or is this actually a really risky practice? So there was a study done in Belgium that surveyed diabetic Muslims. And it's a really, really fascinating study because on one hand, they're looking at Islamic law as this very fixed thing, you know. So one of the survey questions was, do you know that you don't have to do this? You know, so the researchers who wrote the study actually went to a fiqh text and tried to figure out what the law is just by reading the text. And so they go to diabetic Muslims and they say, you know, do you fast? And they found surprisingly 30 or 50% of diabetic Muslims in their study did in fact fast. And then they would ask them follow-up questions like, what are the benefits for you? And some would actually say that they feel healthier, that their sugar levels are actually more controlled during the fasting. A number of Muslims, I think, would say that you sort of get closer to God by fasting.
Talking about Ramadan bringing you closer to God, that's the main thing that I've heard from many people as being the reason for the season, like, yeah, in Christmas, bringing you closer to God. And so
How do you feel that doing that fast specifically brings you closer to God? How do you feel closer by the end of the month?
Well, it's not something that happens. It's something that happens slowly over the month. So you can't really like, at least in my case, I can't really pinpoint a moment where it's like, ah, there it is. I'm closer to God today than I was yesterday. You know, it doesn't quite feel like that. But I think it has to do with, I mean, for me, I think it's like there's kind of two sides to it. One side is like the logical side, which is when I'm choosing to go without, that makes me feel more connected to like the human race in terms of people who don't have the choice, that they can't even necessarily fast because, like, there are Muslims that can't fast during Ramadan, not because they're not healthy enough to do it necessarily, but because they don't have food. So they just have to eat when they can. They can't, you know, choose when to eat and when not to eat. I think feeling that connection with the human race and with other Muslims, just, I think feeling connection makes you feel closer to God. Feeling connection to your fellow man also brings like a connection to God. The other side kind of being the miraculous side of Ramadan, where you can't really explain how it happens. But the fact that I believe that Ramadan is obligatory if you're able to do it, and then the fact that I then do it, means that God told me to do something and I did it for him. And so, of course, I feel closer to him because I'm doing what he's asked me to do. So in a way, it's of course a part of the reward of Ramadan, is that you feel that sense of closeness to God, and that's part of what you get out of listening to his commands, I guess.
So you have these different hadith that will say things like, there's one in particular that I know that comes from his wife Aisha, who says that the Prophet Muhammad for the last 10 days of Ramadan would go into seclusion in the mosque. So this is actually taking the sort of fasting a step further. So instead of, you know, being out and about during the day, you're actually going in, you're living in the mosque. And so you're fasting all day and then praying all night. And this corresponds to, and this is another reason that Ramadan is important and significant, with the very first revelation of the Quran. And so you have throughout the Muslim tradition sort of speculation as to what day exactly that fell on. A number of people will say that it's the 27th of Ramadan, when God gave revelation to Muhammad for the very first time. And so they call this Laylatul Qadr, the night of power, or the night of, there are a few different translations for it. The premise is that with the Quran, you have revelation that comes down from God. And God doesn't just arbitrarily decide one day to just say hi. It's sending down a meaningful message, which is sort of taken to be a guidance for humanity. And that's sort of the central mission of the prophet. But then the problem becomes when you take that as sort of your central idea, that everything that has came down for a reason, you sort of get this idea that what's contained in the Quran itself is a guideline for life. And so the idea is that on this night in particular, there's sort of greater blessings, and by fasting during Ramadan, by observing it, it's as if you fasted for, you know, 1,000 days. And so there, it is absolutely sort of within the Muslim tradition itself tied into different ideas about sort of getting demerits. I'm not the biggest fan of saying sin, because that sort of puts it almost immediately into a Christian register. And especially for Christian audiences, it conjures ideas of sort of original sin and Adam and Eve and this sort of thing. But with a with a system of thought where every single human action is evaluated by a divine figure. Obviously, you sort of accumulate demerits. You do things that bother the divine. You may offend God. You may do things that are very virtuous and sort of accumulate credits. And it's never very clear exactly how this system works. We just know that at some point we're going to be judged, and this is going to be weighed out on some sort of a scale, and all of our actions, all of our deeds, but most specifically our intentions in Muslim thought. And so the idea is that over the year you absolutely make mistakes, even if you don't know. And so this is a good way of making that sort of thing up.
So Ramadan is a centuries-old practice and an obligation for any Muslim seeking to follow the Quran and to grow closer to God. It's complicated by childbirth, by modern medical conditions and complications, and sometimes our life circumstances in any given year just prohibit it. And yet, Ramadan is still around, and it's still being undertaken, celebrated, and cherished by so many people, millions of people around the globe. So what relevance does Ramadan have in this day and age, in this global cultural moment?
You have this sort of, in modernity, you have a very strong desire to return to these sort of rules, to practice right. And you also have a number of different movements that have said that people are not doing what we need in the world, in the Muslim world, in the world in general, is a return to sort of a Sharia, right? And in the United States, Sharia is sort of this incredibly scary thing. I mean, we have legislation banning it from our courts, and we have anti-Sharia protests around the country. And but in among a lot of modern Muslims, there is sort of this idea that at some point in the past, rituals like Ramadan were observed by all Muslims, and that sort of stopped at some point, and people became either westernized or incredibly lazy about religion. And there is, in the modern period, a very strong desire to return to religiosity in order to sort of embed, you know, make not only yourself better, but also sort of your community stronger. Because if you, as a sort of devout person, are able to do this very difficult thing, it shows that it can be done, but it's in a way glorifying the religion, right? So when people say that they're doing it for God, they're also sort of doing it to make Islam greater. You have issues of religious identity in this country. You have issues of sort of minority religion and the majority in America being Christian. Ramadan is sort of, on one hand, something that is visibly Muslim, you know, and it's something that if you're a Christian, you can sort of appreciate. We can all intellectually look at a practice that takes an incredible amount of will and an incredible amount of devotion and recognize that as something that would make somebody devout, something that would make somebody a good practitioner. An observant practitioner, like the example of someone who goes to church all the time, right? And so I do think that there is a bit of incentive in partaking in this sort of a worldwide practice in the modern period as sort of a marker of piety, really, and venerable piety, something that can be appreciated, something that, and I mean, anyone who's lived in the last 50 years knows that Islam very oftentimes is associated with horrible things. And so this is sort of a kind of, I mean, it's very cool and nice and peaceful, and we can appreciate it even if we're not part of the tradition.
And Anna feels a measure of guilt for not being able to carry out this act of devotion to God, these 30 days of fasting, while she's raising and breastfeeding her sons. She finds it difficult to excuse herself from this practice, even though she knows that she could not fast without causing damage to her body.
It's easy to get down on yourself and say, like, oh, gosh, I haven't fasted in 7 years. Like, what must God think of me? Like,
he must be so mad at me.
This is an obligation on every Muslim, and I am failing. But you know, God is merciful, and he does know everything I've ever thought and everything I've ever done and everything I've ever tried to do, and he knows my intentions. And if I look inside myself and I really do wish I could fast and I really do want to be a part of it and I really do want to do the right thing and do what God is asking me to do, and I just can't.
And I can tell that, like, you're sitting here like, oh my God, I feel terrible. Like, it's, I can see that you feel terrible.
So it's important, I think, for moms to be honest with themselves, because it's easy to doubt yourself. And I think as a woman, we doubt ourselves sometimes. I know I do as a woman, that I'm like, oh, I'm just a little, you know, like, I get down on myself, or I think like maybe I'm just confused, you know, like, I kind of like second guess my own thoughts. But, you know, I think that we can be in touch with how we truly feel, and it's important to be in touch with how we truly feel and to recognize that if those good intentions are there, then God knows that, and to find a way to connect with him through that mercy instead of through the fasting. Because if we can't fast, we can't fast. And that goes for non-moms too. There are plenty of people who aren't mothers or who even aren't, you know, men and women that can't fast for health reasons or can't fast for other reasons. So it's a difficult thing. And maybe it's even more difficult than fasting for some people to find a connection through some other method and, you know, try and accept that God can forgive you for this.
God's mercy. It's an easy thing to wish for others, but it's a hard thing to believe that we deserve, even in the times when we need it the most. If we believe in and are followers of a God, can we then accept that God forgives us and has compassion for us when we are not able to carry out the requests that he makes of us? Can we accept that maybe the mercy that God gives during Ramadan, this time when the gates of hell are closed and the gates of heaven are thrown wide open, is not only for the poor, the weak, the hungry, the formerly sinning sinners or the lost lambs among us, but for us too? You're listening to The Hijabi Diaries. I'm Aubrey Cedar. Our co-producer is Anna Mighty, with help from WFHB News Director Wes Martin. The Hijabi Diaries is produced in partnership with the Open-Hearted Campaign to End Islamophobia and with WFHB Bloomington. Special thanks to Abby and to Dale Spicer. For more information on The Hijabi Diaries and to access previous episodes and lots of great extras, visit our website at www.hijabidiaries.com. Eid Mubarak, and as always, thanks for listening. Yeah. Bismillah. May your day be filled with love and light. May your wrongs be right. May your songs be tight. May your words give sight. May your newer shine bright. May you always be on the righteous side of the fight. May your lovers be loyal. May your soil be fertile. May your khaki stay creased. May your locks stay oil. May your plans never get foiled. May your plot thicken.